Yeah, but then we changed it. This is the old one. He didn't make a copy of the new one.
Hello. Hello.
Shirley, do you want a copy?
Can everyone just check that they've got all the documents? There are 6 submissions, so there's Padja up to 6 or 1 to 6. There's a summary of the submissions, which isn't how you can give it a number. No. And then there's obvious, well, the rules of Padja 1 anyway. And then there's copies of the Act. Does anyone need copies of the Act? Okay. All right. There's apologies from the chairperson of the committee, Yunus Karim. Excuse me, he's attending another meeting. It was agreed when he set his date that he wouldn't be able to attend, so I'm going to be chairing in his absence. The attendance, I mean, unfortunately, it's only members of the majority party, 4 of them, no opposition. I think it's unfortunately that time of year when if the issue is not newsworthy, people, if there are no TV cameras, people want to be with the cameras. We've got one person who's going to be making oral submissions, and that's Professor Quino from Stellenbosch. He phoned to say he was running late. I think there were traffic problems on the N1. So we will get to him later. The format I was wanting to follow is for I don't know what you'd call them, the people bringing the rules, the ministry / department / rules board, to make a presentation on the rules. My understanding is that it will be Professor Cheadle as his advisor to the minister, but presumably if the department or the rules board want to add, they can do that. Hopefully by then Professor Quino will have arrived. We would then take his presentation, and then we would want a response from the ministry / department / rules board on the written submission. So if we can follow that format. Okay, so Professor Cheadle, are you ready?
Chair. you have a draft set of rules before you, and the what one is sought to do is to embed the rules inside the rules that apply.
Maybe just to explain, I mean, I think most members of the committee, but from the public's point of view, in terms of the Padja Act, rules have to be proposed by the rules board, submitted by the minister to, shall I do it or do you want to do it? Okay. Proposed by the rules board, submitted by the minister to parliament, and have to be approved by parliament. Our power is limited to accepting or rejecting, although there are other possibilities we could look at if there needs to be amendments. It's a similar procedure really to money bills, and the same informal procedure could probably be followed if there is a need for amendments. This has been an ongoing saga. I think this is the third official version. There was a version that was tabled by Minister Maduna. Goes back to that date. They were withdrawn. There was then a further set that was tabled by Minister Mbanjwa. That's the fourth set, actually. They were withdrawn. There was then a further set that was tabled by Minister Mbanjwa, which Minister Surti withdrew, and we now have this new version before us. So it's been an ongoing issue over a number of years. I think the Padja Act Commercial Act, Administrative Justice Act, required us to adopt rules within 1 to 2 years. But anyway, within a period that we've missed, we extended that period under the Judicial Matters Amendment Act that we passed last year to the end of February. That's just by way of background.
So just to with that background, to understand what these draft rules seek to do, and it was part of what was contentious in respect of the previous rules. So the first issue is, what is the relationship of these rules to the existing rules? Uniform rules of the High Court and the Magistrates Court rules. And the approach adopted here is that those rules will apply to applications for judicial review to the extent that these rules don't modify. I mean, that's in a phrase what is intended. You will see in Rule 1.4 an attempt to capture that idea. So when we think of the rules, really what these rules do is just deal with specific requirements that flow from judicial review of administrative action. The second principle that I think informs these rules is really to try and deviate from the existing rules as little as possible. Now, the model is, of course, the High Court rule. The Magistrates Court rules are similar in some respects and are in the process of being amended. And once those rules are amended, that process we expect to take place long before these rules come into force, then the application rules, the rules that apply to proceedings, application proceedings, and the rules, these are the important rules, rules relating to discovery, in the High Court and the Magistrates Court would to a large extent apply. So again, the second principle here is, let's modify as little as possible, but dedicate it to the kinds of problems that are associated with judicial review. The third principle is really another one of the issues, the contentious issues that arose. And really, if one looks at the different approaches adopted by the different tables, you will see two models. The one model is based on Rule 53 of the Uniform Rules of Court, of the High Court. That model works as follows. You make application in the court to review the decision of an administrator. You call in that application for the record. The administrator then has to make a full copy of the record and submit it to the registrar. Then the applicant, having now had an opportunity to read the record, can now supplement its application paper. And then the normal flow would operate. The respondent or the administrator would respond to the application, and then the normal rules would apply. So that's the one model. That's the Rule 53 model. And it's the model that we've really had for the for many years. Then, when one looks at the other model, and that model is saying, well, let's base our rules on Rule 6 of the Uniform Court Rules. Now, Rule 6 is a complicated set of rules that govern and regulate application. And Rule 35, which deals with discovery. Discovery means getting access to documents, being told what the documents are that are going to be used, and having access to those documents. So you have these two models. And the different tables we've had either went one way or the other. And the concern that arises in relation to the first model, the Rule 53 model, is that the administrator has to prepare a record each and every time. It's called upon to do so. And that can be a mammoth task. That can be a seriously mammoth task if you're dealing, for example, with a competitive bid. If you take the National Lotteries Board, where there were bidders for the National Lottery, you're talking about tens of thousands of pages. Right? If you take fishing rights, the application for fishing rights, where you can have, on some occasions, 2,000 applicants for a fishing right, or 500, with every application being 4 or 5 folders full, you begin to see that the record, inverted commas, as this was interpreted, is a huge amount of documentation, all of which gets copied, all of which is sent to the court, none of which, or very little of which, is ever relevant. So it's a huge burden on the state to do it that way. The problem with the other model, the Rule 6 model, that's where you just use the ordinary rules relating to application, and you can use the rules of discovery, is that you can only get discovery after you've made an application. Now, if you use that approach, then it follows logically that if you want to review a decision, an administrative decision, you make application, then no sooner than you call now for discovery, you look at the document, then you're going to insist on supplementing your original application. And in most instances, that would be granted, because you didn't have the document in front of you. Now, that means a two-stage process, an unnecessary two-stage process. So really what, in order to deal with these two approaches, what we propose here is that you have what is called pre-application discovery. Really, that's really what it is. It says a requester or a person who's really intending to institute action, that person can call upon the administrator to give a list of the documents that the administrator relied on in coming to the administrative decision, And that's just a list. It's not copying the whole thing out. Then the requester can have access to those documents. There is an exception, but just in broad terms, the requester then would go in and look at the documents. And then would copy, is entitled then to copy a document. Now, it may be that there's only 10 pages of a 1,000-page record that is relevant to that person's judicial review. It would be those 10 pages that the requester would copy, and that would then form the basis of the application to court. So what you do away with now is, in this structure, you do away with an automatic production of the record, an unnecessary production, because it depends on your grounds of review. And I'll give you an example of that in a moment. And does away with the supplementation, the two sets of applications every time you apply for judicial review. So that is the thrust of it. Where does the idea come from? Well, it comes from the civil procedure rules in the United Kingdom. The Wolf reforms in the 1970s, those reforms have a pre-application discovery procedure. So their discovery rule, like our discovery rule, they're very similar, has one additional pillar to it. You can ask for discovery of documents. All right. And what discovery means is a list of the documents that are relevant, and then the opportunity to be able to inspect them, and an opportunity to copy them. And you can do that even before you've instituted your action or your application. So what we're really introducing here is something similar to that. It works effectively in the United Kingdom, and we believe since our procedural rules are based very much on English procedural rules, that this use of this will work particularly well in relation to judicial review. Now, what I think comes out of that is the fourth principle, which is that we're doing away with the concept of record, and we're going to the concept of relevant document. And When you look at relevant documents, what is relevant? It's relevant to the ground of review. So let's give this example. Let's assume that the requester, or let's say the person who's been affected by the who wants to challenge the administrative action, challenges the authority of the administrator. Then you don't need the record of the proceeding, because it's nothing to do with authority. What you want to see are the delegation documents. I want to see the document where the mayor has delegated this power to the city manager. Under Rule 53, you would have everything. And what would be missing would be the delegation power, the delegation document. Here what we're saying is the way in which our courts have traditionally used discovery and used the concept of relevance to the case that you're bringing, and you then say, my case is that I'm challenging your authority, I want the documents relating to authority. And then you inspect them, you copy them, and then on the basis of that, you bring your application, or you don't, once you check and see that in fact the delegations were in fact proper. Because one of the side effects, I think, of what we're proposing here is that parties can inspect the documents, they can have a look, and in fact, that very often might mean that they won't bring an application because having looked, they realize they don't have a case. Whereas if you take the challenge, the last challenge to the National Lottery's allocation, that challenge, the party only realized that they had no case after several hundred thousands of rand were expended in legal fees, putting together a record of somewhere near 80,000 pages of documentation. So it's really in that context that I think we see the working. And so the basic process here is for us to harness all our law, all our procedures, all lawyers, all judges are work with discovery all the time. And really what we are supposedly doing is we're taking our discovery rules and providing just a little additional process that you can get discovery before you make the application. And really that resolves, I think, the two basic problems that have been in the way of an agreed set of rules between the ministry and the rules book. Because now we get away with automatic production of the record and the burden that's placed on the state, and we get away from double supplementation, and we provide the citizen with an opportunity to get access to documents to determine whether the administrative action was properly taken in order then to judicially review if it's not. That's the central and core set of ideas in these rules. The balance of the rules, relating, let's say, to affidavits, is the very practical experience of lawyers who act for the state and indeed act also for applicants. When you have an urgent application for judicial review and you're dealing with a minister, you've got to find a commissioner of those at 11 at night because you've got to file your papers the next day. And our view is that you don't need it. Our law of perjury will work just as well, even if it is not signed on by commissioner of those. So we provide that you can have the affidavit signed by commissioner of those, or you have what is called a declaration of truth. Again, this idea was taken from Lord Wolfe's reforms in the UK. They call it a statement of truth. And at the bottom of the affidavit, you say, I declare that what the contents of this affidavit are true. It's a court document. It's used in court. And if you lie, you're guilty of perjury. You don't have to have it commissioned by a commissioner of oath. The second one deals with bundles. Having told you the story of the fishing light, in which I was directly involved in litigation in relation to the fishing rights application, which I might tell you that we filed two, we won every time, and I think we won because precisely because we made documents available to the party. That given the volume that sometimes is associated with We have a specific provision dealing with bunking. Now, of course, in many applications, judicial review, if someone's not getting a social welfare grant or whatever, this won't be applicable. But when you really are dealing with a truly high-powered application, judicial review with thousands of pages, then the bundling of documents becomes really quite important. And the final issue that I just want to address is the complicated issue of these rules applying to all courts. We've taken the view, and when I say we, it's the Rules Board plus the Minister. The Rules Board made the rules, the Minister approved them, but that means, of course, that between us we have to work to get a set of rules that both the Rules Board endorsed and the Minister endorsed, so that we can put it before you and for your approval. And we've interpreted the mandate is that we have to use all proceedings of judicial review, and that means in all courts. And what courts, of course, are the courts as described in PAJA itself, Information and Use of Justice Act, which is the Constitutional Court, High Court, Court of Similar Status, and Magistrates Court. And that means that we have to cover the Electoral Court, we have to cover the Competition Appeal Court, we have to cover the Tax Court, we have to cover the Land Claims Court, and it then became apparent that it's unlikely that you're going to get applications for judicial review in these courts, but it is possible. So we have to cover them, and that might have meant a very detailed set of rules for each one of those courts. In order to avoid that, what we've done in Rule 1 is to say those courts mustn't adapt these rules to their specific purpose. They're not free. They're not free to develop any rules they like. They have to consider these rules and apply these rules to the extent that those that fits within those courts. And if you take the Constitutional Court can be a court of first instance. You can go directly to the Constitutional Court. It is incredibly rare. The court doesn't normally hear cases of first instance. But it could be that you would have a very serious administrative law case that you'd want to bring. Now, given the just the very different nature of the Constitutional Court, the difference of proceedings, what this says to the Constitutional Court is adapt these to suit your specific requirements. And they would do that by way of direction, and they would give those directions. The second problem that we have to deal with is a situation where in ordinary proceedings, the validity of an administrative action is an issue. You're not seeking to set aside the administrative action, but you're relying on it. Right. So that what happens is that you expel a student from the university, and then what the student does is it challenges, let's say, the decision on whatever ground. And the university relies on its action. Now, then what happens is that, of course, that gets challenged in that particular set of circumstances. And so what then the court has to deal with is to deal with the validity of that particular administrative action. So if the student sues in contract, or a breach of contract, it's a contractual case, not a move to justice. The university relies on its administrative action to justify its then it becomes an issue. And then we provide it for in the rules again. Either the court suspends its operation and says, okay, we'll go no further, and we'll refer to the appropriate court to hear the matter, or the court itself then will adapt these rules and deal with the decision in that process. So that's really, I suppose, in the most general way, what we sought to achieve here. And then just to say that representations have been made, and we have taken on board many of the proposals put forward by Professor Freneau, and we are hoping that the informal procedure can proceed. We have developed amendments the rules board and the ministry. The rules board has approved those changes last night, and the minister has approved those changes last night. There may well be further ones that might arise in these discussions, in which case the minister and the rules board obviously would have to be able to respond to it. They are ready and available to do that. And our hope is that if we can make the amendments to be made, we would like to probably withdraw the original tabling and simultaneously put amended new rules before you. And we have marked copies so that the members of the committee can see where the changes have been effected.
Professor Lewis, do you have anything you want to add?
No, I think that. I think Professor Tiedel has expressed the views of the rules board as well. We've, as he said, been through many drafts of these rules, starting out with something very much along the lines of Rule 53 in the High Court. The reason that didn't go through in the very first set of rules that was presented to the Portfolio Committee many years ago was that it created a heavy burden on the state. So I think that the solution outlined by Professor Tiedel is a good solution. I think it balances the interests of the administrator and of the member of the public who is seeking to have an administrative action reviewed.
So basically, though, you are wanting to amend, and in order to do that, in terms of the submissions that you've seen, you are wanting to amend. In order to do that, the minister would have to withdraw, and the new rules would be retabled, latest Monday morning. But you're waiting to see whether there are further amendments that come up in the hearings that the committee may want. I think, are there any questions of clarity from the committee? The process would be, after this sort of part, we then hear from Professor Quinno. I assume that's you at the back. And then after Professor Quinno I think Professor Tiedel again can take us through the submissions and your responses to them. I think it would be good to circulate the amendments that you are wanting to implement. I don't know if you've shown Professor Quinno, but maybe you could just give it to him now quickly so that when he speaks, he can maybe see what you're agreeing to or not agreeing to. But are there any sort of general questions? We'll get on to more detail when we discuss the submissions. Carol?
Thank you. Just maybe not really a question, but more just a comment. Firstly, maybe just to thank both the department and the rules board for the very consultative process that they have followed with these specific rules. I think it makes it a lot easier for us as a committee also to process the rules with the process that has been followed. So thank you for that. And then just to say, I think the idea of, it's entirely the minister's prerogative, but the idea of making amendments, I think, is a good one. Given if one reads Professor Keogh's submission, particularly the problems that he raises in the second Rule 3, which I myself admit did not pick up until I saw it in the submission, and also the issue that he raises regarding time periods, I think there is merit in that. So,
anybody else want to say anything, JB, Elizabeth, Gillian, Christine? No, okay. Are you ready? Am I pronouncing your name correctly? Okay.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Sorry, hold on. Okay.
I would think.
thinking beforehand of taking all the submissions and then getting the response, and the response will then include the amendments that the Rules Board and Ministry are proposing, because otherwise it's going to wander all over the place. So I think let's follow that procedure for now. So Professor Quinn, although you haven't seen what they're prepared to accept or not accept, I think just talk. Usually time-wise, what's the usual time allocation? How long would you need to present? I mean, it's...
Chairperson, I can be fairly quick about it, as I've placed my written submissions before the committee. So, I mean, what I would really like to do is just flag one or two issues. I'm very glad to hear that some of it has hit home, and also some of the remarks coming from the committee just now, because those are my primary concerns. So I won't need a lot of time, as I've put my detailed written submissions before the committee in any case. But, I mean, you can give me an indication of time.
It's difficult. It's a bit arbitrary to give. I mean, I think try and go through it. I mean, the submission has been made. It's patch of 5. I think just flag the key issues.
Thank you very much, Chair. As I said, I've put my detailed submissions before the committee, and so I would just flag one or two issues, but I would really just talk to what I consider to be the main issue, and that's the one of the disclosure mechanism in the new Rule 4. So I'll spend some time on that, but let me just flag the other issues. As the committee members mentioned now, there is the question about the request for reasons and whether that's properly in these rules. The view I take is that it's not. It'll simply be ultra vires, the Rules Board, to try and make rules on this matter, and specifically to have them in these set of rules. My view is that they should simply be removed. I see no reason for duplication of something that's already existing in regulation form. There may be forms added to those regulations as in the format we've got under these rules. I just don't see the point of having it in these rules. So my view would be that should just simply be removed here. Moving on then, just skipping my submissions on rules 4 and 7, which I'll come back to. I was a bit concerned about the new rule 8. There have been issues in the court about who do you cite as respondent, and we haven't had clarity on that. I'm glad to see that that's been addressed. I think there can be more clarity on how that can be squared with the State Liability Act, if the State Liability Act applies at all to judicial review proceedings, which is another question. But perhaps one can be just a bit clearer in, I think, sub-rule 9 of rule 8, in saying whether one going to stick to the current practice of fighting the nominal head. And then a major and perhaps last quick issue before I go to Rule 4 is the Form C. I was really surprised to see what I consider to be new standing rules introduced to our law. I do not think that Form C, in the way that it requests an applicant to point to its rights being materially and adversely affected, and that's leaving aside representative capacity for a moment, whether that's the correct statement of the law as it's been to this day, whether changes to that position can be done via rules like this, I've got my doubts. The position, as I understand it at the moment, is that an applicant can bring an application, again, not talking about representative capacity, when objectively a right has been impacted upon, and secondly, he's got an interest in the remedy. That's a far cry, in my view, from having to point which rights have been adversely materially affected, which is quite a heavier burden. Bringing into that picture the administrative law doctrine of legitimate expectations following the recent Walele judgment by the Constitutional Court, it's difficult for me to see how, under these rules, you will be able to indicate why you're coming to court if you're making a purely legitimate expectations argument. So I think there's the issue there, whether you'll simply point to your Section 33 rights and say my Section 33 rights have been infringed, whether that will be enough. Maybe that may be the case indeed, but then it's a bit silly having this requirement, because then under these rules you will always just say, look, I'm coming to court, my Section 33 1 or 2 rights have been infringed. So I've got a bit of difficulty there. But getting back to the Rule 4 new disclosure mechanism, which Professor Cheadle's talked about mostly as well. I welcome this new rule. I think it's a very good one. But there are specific issues. And the first, and to my view, one of the biggest problems is the time frame. Having 15 days to request these documents, which I read the rules correctly, and the Cheadle's now basically confirmed my understanding that you won't have a chance again. And to me, that is a bit difficult to swallow, especially with the 15-day period. It's a very short period of time. It may work in a country like the UK. I haven't looked at their time frames recently, but we need to keep the realities of our country in mind. And we need to bear in mind that judicial review, quite often in this country, as indicated by the judgment extract I attached to my submissions, take place in areas where people are far from legal representation, where they do not have ready access to all these legal niceties, technicalities. I think to expect people to ask for a list of documents within 15 days, however calculated, is, I think, problematic. Specifically when that is compared with the current position where you've got basically 180 days. Because you can file your notice of motion at 180 days and then get access to the record and even amend your notice of motion after that. So restricting it to 15 days, to my mind, is highly problematic. I would certainly like to see that time period extended. But I do have a problem as well with this relevant document provision, and I hear the justification for it, and I think there are very good reasons for it. But I think I need to bear in mind the realities here, and that's that. Quite often, an applicant is not able to exactly point to which grounds of review, especially if we're talking about grounds of review in Section 62 of PUDGE, not even just talking about the Constitution. So it may be very difficult for an applicant to say exactly what he or she is going to argue, wants to argue, before he's seen the record. That's exactly why the current Rule 53 allows for an amendment of the notice of motion following the record being filed. At the moment, the way that this procedure is set out is exactly that the applicant is required to set out what he wants to argue, what she wants to argue in court, and only those documents will be provided. Nothing else. Now, you know, to my view, one or two things will happen. Either we will just miss a lot of stuff on judicial review, because organs of state will now be able to just not list any document where there may be issues if it's not, in their view, relevant to the identified grounds of review. But secondly, and I think this is more likely to happen, applicants are simply going to list either the whole Section 6.2 or major parts of it. And it's going to be very difficult to decide which of those are legitimate, which are not, going into making a call on whether a specific document is relevant or not. I would expect to see that large records will still have to be at least listed and then made available, because I would imagine that most applicants seeing a list of relevant documents would simply want to see all of it. And I think that will remain a fishing expedition as it is at the moment, unfortunately. So, I mean, I say this while welcoming Rule 4. I think it's good to have pre-notice of motion discovery mechanism. But one has to think about what's going to be the practical realities. Unfortunately, I think the practical realities are going to be that applicants are simply going to continue asking for it. I think the solution may be to think about mechanisms, putting in place mechanisms to judge the relevance call. Is it simply going to be done by the administrator? Is the administrator going to say, look, you've simply listed the whole Section 6.2 of PUDGE as your grounds of review, which means I basically have to provide you with everything. You know, if you want to, for example, assess reasonableness under either Section 6.2F2 or Section 6.2H, it's difficult to do that without having seen basically the entire record. So, you know, I was just wondering whether it would not be possible to add a mechanism where, in terms of which the relevance can be judged. If it's going to be done by the administrator, one needs to think about whether that in itself is going to be administrative action, and whether that in itself can be subjected to scrutiny. On the one hand, one would want to see that because it'll be highly problematic for an administrator to be able to circumvent the judicial review process by simply deciding that something is not relevant or is relevant. On the other hand, it of course again adds the burden that Professor Cheadle's been talking about. That now you can stop the procedure, you can have it reviewed by some mechanism. But I think certainly some thought has to go into this. How is one going to prevent a fishing expedition from continuing under beach rules? I think that basically outlines my concerns with these rules. Just the last thing that I think I want to flag is there's no mention in these rules about what's going to happen regarding an administrative decision to list documents on part two of Schedule A of Form D, which would be the list that you can't get access to. How are we going to deal with that? I see nothing in these rules. I find it a bit strange that there are detailed rules dealing with what would happen if an administrator doesn't list or if he lists and doesn't want to supply the documents, but nothing on what's going to happen if he lists on the part two, non-available documents. Don't we want to have some form of scrutiny there as well? I think that basically outlines my major concerns. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Professor. From the committee, first question to Professor Quinnow. Carol.
Maybe just on the whole Form 2 thing, maybe just if Mr. Quinnow could make the whole thing about you argue that legitimate expectation also for part of administrative action, really, as I understand it, is the bottom line. Any proposed wording or suggestion as to how you think the form should read?
Well, I'm just wondering whether it's necessary at all to have those standing requirements in these forms. I mean, standing is something for the court to assess in the end, so why have it in Form C? I fail to see, you know, for whose benefit is it there? Is it for the administrator's benefit? And if that's so, why do we think that the administrator can assess legal standing? So I would just suggest removing all of that from Form C.
But if you removed it, wouldn't you have just simply opened the gates? I mean, that anyone then can apply for anything, and this problem of the burden on the state. Whereas if you have a limitation, which then is, I would see, is probably there to protect the administrator, if it's being unfairly applied, then you can take that further, but at least with some kind of limitation.
Well, I have great difficulty in allowing administrators to decide whether somebody's got standing to challenge that very administrator's decision. I think that's problematic. And to my mind, Form C only for the administrator's benefit in the sense of it's a form directed at the administrator. I have difficulty in allowing an administrator to make that call if the administrator is really actually the other party to the potential proceedings at that stage. Whether one can build that into the relevance requirement, I'm not sure. I don't know. Perhaps, and perhaps we can just have some response whether simply indicating that your Section 33 rights have been violated, whether that would be adequate. Because then I doubt whether this serves any purpose whatsoever.
Just before we get a response from the Ministry, Rules Board, Department, whatever, is your view then that anyone effectively should be able to ask for disclosure of any documents relating to any administrative decision? Because is that not effectively what you're proposing?
Well, what I'm proposing is that anyone contemplating review should be able to use this mechanism. And if somebody can formulate grounds of review that he or she is planning, abstractly planning to bring, I think that must follow.
I'll ask for the response just now. Further questions from the committee or the researchers? Not at this point, okay. Just to say also, Professor, I mean, this is going to be quite informal, so although you're on the floor, I think you're like you to stay and engage further on other issues. I mean, we'll try and become less formal. Professor Cheadle.
Let me just start with Rule 3. The argument is that our Rule 3, which deals with the request for reason, falls outside of procedural rules for judicial review. Now, it's certainly my view and the view of senior counsel. We've had senior counsel and junior counsel advising us in this process. Advocate Germany ESC and Advocate Duval, that's the Cape Town Bar, both the people who engage have evidence of law practice. Now, it's our view that Rule 3, that you can't separate reason from review. If you think about it, almost every ground of review relates to the reason. Not everyone, but most of them do. Secondly, it's critical to the architecture of these rules. You start with a request for reasons if you haven't got them. Then you go for a request for disclosure if you haven't got them. And then you go to court if they refuse to give you a reason or they refuse to give you documents. And then you make your application. So our view is that it falls within rules for judicial review proceedings. And just to demonstrate the kind of problem is that the act specifically says that that you. Let me leave that argument aside. However, to put it beyond doubt, we've taken on board what Professor Crino has said. We think that it's arguable, that his case is definitely arguable. And we don't want this to be an arguable proposition, though we think that there's almost no risk that anyone's going to challenge this. But we're interested in making good law. And the proposal that has come up is as follows. The minister last night approved a regulation that will read something along these lines. It will amend chapter, I think it's chapter 4 of Request for Reason. It will amend it, and the thrust of it will be procedure for requesting reason shall be. Shall be the procedure contained in Rule 3 of the Rules of Court. So, and all we will be doing then is taking, the minister clearly has that power. No, that's unquestionable. And then all that one is doing then is putting it in the rules. And the effect then, and we didn't want it to just do it by reference, we didn't want to put the rules in the regulation and then just say, request according in accordance with the regulations, because then if we look at the ordinary person who's wanting to try and find out what to do, they have to then find the regulations and they find everything else. And what we want in terms of both the architecture of these provisions is to have it there. So I think rather than have a legal argument about who's right and who's wrong, I think this proposal resolves it. That the power comes from the minister, and then it's contained in our rules. And it's necessary because what we see, even though you have a request for reason, a request for variation of time, which the Act provides for, and you can go to court in relation to a time period that you want reduced or extended, and not to have any procedure for that seems to me unwise. And then a request for disclosure of information. That in many cases, those applications will be made at the same time. In other words, there's nothing that prevents you, in fact, asking for reason, asking for information, and
arctic variation and climate, you can see how each of these things is structured. And when you go to court, there's nothing to say that you can't, in fact, go for each of them. So I think, overall, I think that we resolve the problem. The minister publishes a regulation, and that really happens in this rule, is exactly what the minister has promulgated. So that's rule three. Rule four is the request for disclosure. The concerns there, the concern is that the applicant very often doesn't know what grounds of review. Well, then you must go to PIA. But you can't even use Rule 53 in the High Court. If you don't know what your grounds of review are, you can't bring an application. You have to bring an application before you get the full record under Rule 53. You have to make out a prima facie case. You can supplement, but the question is, you can't go there and say all the grounds of review without any basis whatsoever. And in fact, if you look at most applications under Rule 53, there is a basis. They do lay a basis. But when they go and they look at the record, they find out that they've got something more. And an additional ground, further ground. So really, if you really strip away Rule 53 and say, all we're saying is you've just got to meet the same standards as you would have had to do under Rule 53. And that's a request. So you've got to lay it out. You've got to lay something out. And really, for me, there's no difference. Yes, it can be a fishing expedition, but at least the fishing here does not actually mean the administrator to catch the fish, freeze it, and bring it through to the restaurant, all 500 bundles of the damn stuff. Want to fish? Then you can fish in the administrator's pot. You just go there, and you have to read all the documents. You have to copy them. So, and that's really the thrust of it. To say that to draw up a list is burdensome, well, let me say to you, well, there's got to be some burden on the administrator. No one's saying there's no burden, but the burden of drafting a list of what documents you relied on to come to your decision is very different from having to photocopy, certify them, and send them through to the registrar of the court, which the court very seldom looks at because it's probably only one or two pages or 10 pages of it that is relevant. So yes, it is a burden to list. And that burden is infinitely less than actually copying everything. So we sense that you should spell out what documents rely on. And of course, as I say, it's reliant on the grounds of review. And if you do challenge it on the basis of rationality, unreasonable, then of course any transcription. So if they want a record in its true sense, a transcription of proceedings. In the liquor, before the liquor board, right, then that transcription, you would have to transcribe and get, and then on the basis of that, you would look at it, and then you would bring your application. So that is a relevant document, okay? But it's not relevant to authority, or to bribery, or to many of the other grounds. And I think Professor Quinault's right that most reviews are always unreasonable. But it's much better to produce a list than to produce the whole record. And what will happen then is the applicant would look and say, listen, 50 pages of this of the listed documents, I've looked at them all, 50 pages are relevant, and I attach them then in terms of my my application here, I've attached them, these are the relevant ones. Well, if the administrator is opposing the application, or another respondent is opposing it, they might say, no, no, that's cherry picking. You've cherry picked the record here. And then they, using the same mechanism, of course, would then supplement the papers with additional parts of the record. The judge himself or herself could quite easily say, I don't have enough here. I want further and better discovery. Now, one point I want to make very clearly here, this pre-discovery is just one extra leg to our normal rule of discovery. all the normal rules apply. And that means that you can apply for discovery after application and before pleading for claim under Rule 35. It's a court-regulated process in an application. So Rule 35 just applies. And you can go for further and better discovery if you're unhappy with the discovery that you've got at pre-application. But you have to do that after the application. Now let's look at the problem. And it's a problem that Professor Quino has raised and has caused us, let's say, some concern. And that is that what you're not allowed to do in a pre-application procedure is to challenge the categorization. And we have a normal discovery affidavit. This is an affidavit that the administrator would sign, which is applying the normal discovery rule. There are two schedules. The first schedule is divided into two parts. The first part lists all the relevant documents, okay, to which the requester or the applicant can have access to and copy. The second part of that schedule are relevant documents which the requester or applicant can't have access to because, for example, the law of privilege, the attorney-client correspondence, confidentiality, a whole range of issues. That's the second part of the schedule. The second schedule deals with the relevant documents that were in the possession of the administrator, but now in the possession of someone else. And then what the administrator says, these are the documents, the relevant documents, and they are with the second, third, and fourth respondent, because he's given that stuff back to them. Now, so what one is doing is harnessing, as I said, these discovery rules. So at the pre-application stage, you can't challenge that categorization. Otherwise, we're going to have applications taking place. And the real fear here is that this is a very expeditious procedure and that people will start using this rather than PIRA. So our real concern here is that we want to ensure that this is generally for the purposes of instituting a judicial review. And secondly, for ensuring that you don't bypass PIA to get to access the confidential documents. You'll remember that under PIA, you have a whole long process and a set of protection for third-party interests in documents. And what we were concerned about at a pre-application stage is that this would then allow people to bypass PIA. And that's our central concern. And so you get the documents. Spells out the relevance, you have to spell out why this document can't be disclosed in the discovery affidavit. And remember, it's an affidavit. And if you lie, you're subject to perjury. But apart from what happens to cost in the matter, when the court discovers that you have secreted relevant documents which are not confidential or not privileged into the second part of Schedule A. The discovery rules continue after you've made application, and it's then, once you've made application, you're in court, you can challenge the categorization. As any other litigant can challenge the categorization in the discovery affidavit under Rule 35. And so, really, that's the, our response to Professor Quino in relation to Rule 4. I want to say that the Supreme Court of Appeal, in a matter called Tetra Mobile, shortened name for it, has already granted pre-application, what we call pre-application discovery. In that case, what happened was an administrator made a decision. The applicant wanted to have sight of the documents upon which the administrator had made that decision for the purposes of appealing to the minister, I think it was, in that particular case, and the Supreme Court of Appeal granted it. So, second argument as to why I think, and Professor Quinn doesn't dispute, I mean, in fact, he encourages and thinks the pre-application procedure is a good one, is our attempt here. Certainly from the moment the ministers made the final decision, right, internal remedies have been then we've got a procedural rule to deal with what we would say is the tetramobile type jurisprudence that we expect in the court. Let me now just deal with the question of Form C. The form was undergoing several changes in the process, and he's quite right. The standing issues were incorrectly stated. They have now been corrected. And so you've got to spell out on what basis you were coming. And I think when the chair asked the question, but if you don't ask those questions, what is your capacity? On what basis are you asking for this? Then you've got to say, well, my rights have been materially negotiated. Or you say, I'm bringing your representative capacity. Well, spell out what your representative capacity is. Or I'm bringing the public interest. Well, spell it out. Now, why in a form to the administrator? Well, because this form triggers an application in court down the line. And we want the administrator and the applicant to apply their minds to what is going to be a decisive question in the grant or refusal by a court of pre-application assistance. You don't have standing for judicial review, you don't have standing for pre-application. We don't want that to be sorted out by accident in court when the court says, by the way, what kind of standing have you got? So what we want to do is to have it in the form. The administrator, let's say, wrongly, says, I don't think you've got standing. I don't recognize your NGO, therefore I'm not giving it to you. Well, that will just trigger an application. The court will look at it and say, no, I'm sorry. These people do have legal standing and are giving an order that you grant access to these documents. So, bear in mind, this is a form to the administrator that triggers an application to court if the documents aren't granted. And part of the, it's clear that what really has to happen in relation to these rules is that a fair amount of training got to take place for administrators to be able to deal with this new process, and that is the that's why we've departed from the normal provision in rules that the rules come into force in a date stipulated in the publication of the rules themselves. What we propose in the amended version is that the minister brings the rules into force by notice. So the rules are going to be published, but they only come into force in a notice down the line when the minister is relatively certain that judges, magistrates, and administrators have had some training in actually dealing with these issues. The other aspect I am going to leave to my colleague in the ministry. She dealt with all the written representations, and I suggest we say they're fairly technical ones, and we've taken on board and the some of the specific issues raised by the petitioner, that she deals with that when we deal with all the representations, because then we can also show you the amendments that we propose in relation to them.
Two issues from Professor Quinno's submission that I thought were more specific. Some other people also picked up on them, but the issue of whether Rule 3 was ultra vires, beyond the powers of the rule board, the request for reasons, and the other was the 15-day period in Rule 4. So will she cover those, or do you want to deal with those?
I think I've dealt with Rule 3. What we propose is that the minister will publish a regulation to the effect that the procedure for requests will be the procedures contained in the rules.
You've dealt with the overlap issue, yeah, but you haven't dealt with the issue of whether the rules board has the power to make rules relating to requests for reasons.
But the point is that once the moment the minister makes them the procedure, then all we're doing is copying them. So we resolve that issue. But in any event, you'll remember my starting point is this, that our opinion is that you can't conceive of judicial review for the most part without reason. And it forms part of the architecture of this, we think it's intra vires, but to put it beyond doubt, the suggestion was that we will make the amendments to the regulations, Chapter 4 of the regulations, that just say that Rule 3 is the procedure. I think that there is a compelling case, certainly when you read it. Except this, that first of all, I must remember we're talking about in the rule court days, not ordinary days. So 15 days turns into, in fact, 3 weeks. And what we propose is to make it 20 days, so it's almost a month. But bear in mind that you can bring it at any time. So you can bring it any time before reasons are given. And then once the reasons are given, then you launch this application. The reason is that the great problem that the Act gave us in setting it out is that it's got time periods of 90 days and 90 days. 90 days to request a reason and 90 days to reply to a reason and 180 days to bring an action. So quite frankly, apart from the variation of time, which is now we provide for, that if the requester, someone who wants to bring a case, brings it on the last day of the 90 days, and the administrator then, the 90 days, well then 180 days is over. So then you can't bring the action without the variation of time. So what we tried to do was to create some kind of structure inside the 180 days so that you could apply for reasons, you can get your reasons, you can apply for and free disclosure, and you've got enough time after that to make an application. Now, in the moment you make it in 3 months or 6 months, then it's going to completely get in the way of this 90-day cap. So, really, what we want to do is we could make it 30 days. But I can say the moment you're getting anywhere over that, you're going to get seriously into trouble with the really unfortunate fact that you put days in the statute rather than the regulation, which you can check and see how it works. And to have a system where you have 90 days to give reasons, 90 days to request reasons, 90 days to give reasons, 180 days to institute action. Thank goodness that there's variation, but it really does create enormous complexity. So I think we're talking about court today, and we thought a month seemed to be roughly a month, 22 days, but one doesn't want to use one to contract 10 days, 20 days, 30 days. And really it's up to we very interested, I think, to discuss, but I would be very concerned if we went beyond 30 days, because then you really are talking about 5-6 weeks now, and that's the problem. If you have public holidays, then you really are looking at 6 weeks on some occasions.
The upper limit, the 15 days or 20 days, depends on whether reasons have been requested. What happens if they're not requested because they were given when the decision was taken?
That means that you can bring it at any time. No. And even if he doesn't give reasons, you can do it. That's the structure of it. What we want to do is that having requested it and having been furnished, then it's followed.
I mean, if the reasons are given right from the start, so you don't actually need to follow Section 5, you don't need to follow Rule 3, because when they took the decision, they gave the reasons. Section 5 is a request for reasons. Rule 3 is a request for reasons. Shouldn't there be a limit there? Maybe it would be a wording.
Well, you see, that's the problem that arises there is that the Act doesn't just say
90-day and your 180-day. The one is the date at which the administrative action is given. The next way is when you learnt it. And the third way is when you reasonably could have learnt it. Now, again, that's the kind of stuff that you should find in rules, not in statutes, because it makes 180 days really quite difficult to manage and then to embed rules inside of that structure. So now, it's the knowledge of the decision, if the reason is given at the same time, then you've got that problem. And at the same time, if you put no period here at all, then I'm not saying this isn't difficult. I just don't know how to solve it. So the problem for us, the way we did it was, if you request a rule, then we know there's a date upon which you must do it. If the reasons are given at the date the decision is made, well, then you can bring it. You can bring it any time. And you've got to institute proceedings in 180 days. So there'll be a natural tendency to bring it in and before the institution of action. We thought of doing it from the 180-day period, but then it became really quite difficult in order to say you've got to bring it. You can't bring it within 15 days of the 180-day period. This is problematic, but I think it's part of the architecture that if you request reasons, then you must, if you want to proceed, you must do it within a certain time. If the reasons are given at the time the decision is made, then you're free to do it at any time.
But yeah, I think, look, I don't want to belabor the point, but my problem with this approach is that you are really not encouraging administrators to give reasons at the time of taking the decision, which I think would be the best case scenario. You know, you take a decision and you say, here are the reasons why I took the decision. But if you do that, you're then opening yourself up to request for disclosure at any stage within the 180 days or whatever. Whereas if you follow the more conservative attitude, if you simply make the decision, you don't give reasons, then you know that 15 days, 20 days from the date within which you give reasons, then there's a cutoff. And isn't it a simple thing to simply say not later than 20 or 15 days from the date at which reasons are furnished? Either full stop, because it would then either be that would include if they're given up front, or if they're furnished under Section 5 and Rule 3, or 15 days, list the whole lot, 15 days after from the date on which they're furnished under Section 5 or Rule 3, or at the time of the decision being taken. But I don't know if you sort of see that, but my worry is that you're discouraging, I would have thought you're discouraging administrators from giving reasons up front, which is, I think, something that they should be encouraged to do. But I don't know. Other members, sorry, Carol?
I think it's just to accept that we all know that they don't do it.
I know they don't. But, I mean, I'm talking about, it would be good if they did, and this is discouraging that. Because you're assuming they're not going to do it, and there's no space then effectively for them to do it. But anyway, that just made me think about that one. Other questions, Carol?
I'm just wondering, and Professor, you know, raise it as well, does the State Liability Act apply? Because that's got a completely different time frame. And I wasn't sure in my own mind that it did apply or not. I didn't think that it would, but I'm not sure.
We don't think it does apply, and we in fact did a redraft to include the minister as a nominal respondent, and put the draft before senior counsel and junior counsel, and they were utterly horrified at the petition. They said that is actually the worst possible thing to do. That you don't want a nominal respondent. You want to direct to the administrator, and if the administrator's institution, board, whatever it is, you cite it. And then if the person is a functionary, then you, like a registrar of pensions, then you cite the pension. And the way that our rule works, I think, resolves a lot of the problems that are associated with citing the response. Now, we're talking about citing not citing the Minister of Health and the Minister of Finance. They have different interests, they say, in a particular matter. We're talking about citing the Minister of Finance, the DG of Finance, the and any one of the institutions underneath it. And what we try and achieve in that rule is, and we've gone back to it, is that the administrator, responsible for the administration, must be cited with the respondent. And then 9, if the administrator is a functionary, now where does functionary come from? Well, the definition of organ of state. And that's referred to in Bajor rule, and that refers back to the Constitution. And we're using the language of the Constitution here. We're using the language of Bajor. And so the functionary is not be cited as a respondent, if the functionary is the Department of State Administration or Institution of Bajor. Doesn't stop them. But we hope that this will encourage them no longer to cite a string of four or five people doing the same thing. And we say that if you cite the minister, the DG, and the registrar, all right, of pension, all three, then this allows the court to deny you costs in relation to having to be cited. So that's really our issue.
Okay, I think before you take us to other amendments then, Professor Quinno, anything else at this stage? I mean, you're welcome to, and you're encouraged rather, not just welcome to participate. I mean, once you've seen the amendments that are made, but anything else at this point? I don't want to have a debate between you, but you can make some comments if you like.
Thank you, Chair. I was running a lot of things now because the teacher was talking, so I'm thinking of the one or two things that I would like to put on the table. I mean, I do think the time period is simply too short. That's just my view. So I think that's something that needs to be considered. I'm still not convinced that 20 days is enough. I think we need to consider our reality. For people living in rural areas, dependent on social welfare, decisions taken against them, to within 20 days, get to a legal representative, because let's be honest, there's no way that a citizen can use these forms or these rules themselves. And that's another point I want to get to in a minute. To get to legal representation, to get the money not just to pay or to give in some indication to be able to pay, to get the money for transport. These are the realities we're dealing with. And then to find that the cutoff date is beyond them. And then to be in a position where it's really much, much more difficult to launch a successful review application. To my mind, it's problematic. I would certainly push for a much longer period of time. I think there's a reason why there's 180 days in the Act. And I think that reflects something of this reality. The second point is the one about formality. And that goes to a number of issues we talked about on Form C, for example. But, you know, I think that one of the advantages of the pre-notice of motion discovery mechanism is, in fact, the informality that it can bring about. The fact that a citizen and potential applicant can, in fact, do it him or herself, doesn't need legal representation to do it. I think that's great. That can be a huge advantage in the process. But adding legal technicalities like standing to that form, I think it's problematic because it's very difficult, even for sophisticated applicants, non-legally trained applicants, to identify those technical things. I just think it undermines the potential informality one can get here that can be a huge advantage to this mechanism. I think it is an advantageous mechanism if we can keep it simple and not a sophisticated legal process. And then perhaps lastly, I have to say, while I'm always very unwilling to disagree with my erstwhile colleague, Advocate Johan de Waal, I do disagree on that point. It may be that you can't see judicial review without reason, but you can certainly see reasons without judicial review. And one of the things we've been trying very hard to do with our new administrative law is to get away from the idea that it's the law of judicial review. And this view, keeping reasons within the rules for judicial review, will continue that view that reasons is something that exists within judicial review and not outside of it. despite the nice technical footwork that's now been put in place, that I think will solve my technical argument about who's got the power to make these rules. I think that's the solution does solve it. I think it's a pity, though, because I think a reason as a mechanism, in terms of Section 32 of the Constitution, in terms of Section 5 of Paja, exists completely independently from judicial review and should do so. And it's part of a participatory democracy view that I think is completely apart from judicial review, and I think it's a pity to have it done.
Any other comments, questions, Elizabeth?
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is on page 10 of the rules and procedures. It seems as if that the rules and procedures are made for urban people. I'm referring to subsection 7A and again B on page 11, where the physical address and method of delivery by hand, that address must be within 25 meters of the office of the registrar, meaning which we are urban bias in our rules, and we are not thinking of the rural people who are definitely not all staying 25 kilometers within the registrar's office. Can I get clarity on that, please?
Thanks, Father. I think one of the quite important changes that are made here in these rules about service and delivery is that you can serve documents by fax or email. And I know that doesn't entirely assist you. You can also do it by registered post. But if you have a look at sub-rule 7 on page 10, it says that if the address is a physical address as opposed to an email address, a fax address, a registered post address, different. And the method of delivery is by hand. In other words, this is the applicant saying, I want it to be delivered by hand, then you must have the physical address in 25 kilometers. Our existing rules are 8 kilometers. All right. And the reason for 25 is that's what the Constitutional Court says. It's probably more descriptive Johannesburg than elsewhere. So the idea here is what precisely to allow the applicant states where you can serve it. It's only if it's physical and it's to be delivered by hand as opposed to by post that the 25-kilometer rule applies. And you can see it that if you are an administrator and you want to serve on any room in the court, so the courts are in the town. That's your other problem, I agree with you, but then we've got to get the courts out, and one of the points about having magistrates' courts and dealing with these kinds of actions is precisely to spread the judicial review to many more and much closer to the rural area. But you're dealing effectively with 9 high courts, a couple of the local divisions, you're talking about 12 places in the country, 12 or 13 places in the country, and it's only around that area that we're speaking about. But what we really do here is we really do make it much easier for people in the rural area. But
I'd just add to that, it's important to see that this requirement applies also to the administrator. So if you look at the top of page 11 in the notice of opposition, the administrator's also got to state an address within 25 kilometres of the office of the registrar of the court. Now, in the Act, the basis of territorial jurisdiction is very different from it usually is in civil proceedings. Usually the applicant's got to go and institute proceedings where the respondent is. This Act says the applicant may institute proceedings in the court of the area where the applicant is. So the administrator will also have to have an address within 25 kilometres that court, because otherwise if the applicant chooses by hand, the applicant may have to go and deliver in Pretoria if there wasn't this requirement. So it's something which has been a very vexed question for the Rules Board over many, many years, because there are an advantage to litigants, and in other ways it can be a disadvantage. What we are doing with regard to the magistrate's court rules, the amended court rules, is just making sure that the court has the power to override that, to take into account the facts in any particular case.
Look, I think you have made an improvement. It's still a problem. I mean, Ms. Galeka's from the Northern Cape. I mean, the distances between magistrates' courts. I mean, effectively, it means you've got to find somebody who can receive the documents for you. So it doesn't have to be your address, but you can find your relative friend who's living in the town where the court happens to be, and say, okay, if the documents can be delivered there. But I think it's, I don't know how one addresses it, but I think it's an overall problem that would need to be looked at in the longer term. I mean, I think the whole issue of because now one is thinking of you know, Ma Zondi, who had her pension application, disability grant application refused. You know, does she need to get a lawyer to actually take the process on review? I mean, I think within that SASA there is an appeal mechanism anyway. Is it a review or an appeal? Review, sorry. Appeal, okay. So that has its own thing. I don't know how that works. I think the word problem is with the minister, national minister, not delegating to, used to be held by MECs, then it went to national minister. I think they've now been delegated back down again. But anyway, I think it's a wider problem, but I think it's an important issue to pick up on. But I think you want to then take us through the amendments you're wanting to make to the rules.
Representations that were received. And on the third line, we've added and Parliament, because these will be suggested after they've been approved by Parliament, as that is a requirement. And on the second to last line at the bottom, we've removed the word appropriate procedure. On the second page, application. Index to the rule 8, we've added for judicial review to make it clear that, because there are other application procedures in the rule, so we've added those words. And then rule 14 and 15, this was an error when we tabled the rules. We had a wrong heading here. We had court made the part from the rules and practice notes. It should have been power of court to give direction and title and review. There was some confusion about the application of these rules, so we've changed this to ensure that it's quite clear that when a proceeding is instituted in a court, the rules of that court apply insofar as there's not a conflict with these tribunals, provided that the rules related to application and discovery apply subject to the provisions of Rules 8 to 12 respectively, which deal with the discovery in the Pajan rules. And to make it clear also that Rule 53 of the Uniform Rules of the High Court and Rule 7A of the Rules for the Conduct of Proceedings in the Labour Court no longer apply in proceedings for judicial review. This was something that was also brought up by look at two sets of rules. For example, Rule 53 in the High Court and the Quadrant Rules, the relationship between these two sets of rules should be more clearly set out.
Zati, do you have hard copies of this as well? Can they be given out? I mean, it's fine going through them on the screen, but once you pass an area, if people want to look, they can be given out as you go through. Thanks.
Clear what point in time the failure also know before you put out that with the wrong subsection of the Act, the internal remedies are actually referred in Section 7.2A of the Pledge Act and not C, so we've changed that. In Rule 8, we've added FOIA judicial review. Make it clear that this is the section of your application review. And Sub-Rule B, we've also pointed out by the legislative branch that it should be clarified that an application should be brought within the time period referred in Section 7 of the PUDA Act, or varying in terms of Section 9 of the Act, which is the section of your variation.
When you don't have it in front of you when it's moved from the screen. Where the forms, have they been copied or they still have to be copied?
They still have to be copied, but really there's only, if I'm right, it's only this page that we need to show you.
Fine, but then can we get that page copied? I mean, if this is difficult, it will disappear from the screen. So maybe take us through it, but I don't know why we weren't, if somebody was making copies of the amended rules, why they couldn't have done this single page.
There's a further problem, you can't see it.
On the
hard copy.
Well, it doesn't.
Okay, take us through it.
And then also in regards to the representative capacity in
What I suggest is that we'll, I think it's if you use colour, it just doesn't come through. What we'll do is we'll just get underlining, and that will make the form just so much clearer. And we'll do that while we engage with the other representation.
Now, show me
though,
the amendments on the rules. I mean, it's come out on the side, so I'm not sure why you wouldn't be able to see it.
It's a question of boxes and Microsoft, and we don't want to start a discussion about just how frustrating it is to work with an appalling technology. The second problem is we've got it in blue, and so blue doesn't print out. And I really, what I suggest is, can we just have we'll just underline the changes. And then you can work out from the form that you have what's been taken out. And we can do that. That's really what we can do in test circumstances. And they're not major because the effect of the changes here is just simply to say, you've just got to say what your capacity is. And then a little note at the bottom says, legal standing means you have material adversely affected, or you know representative capacity, or in the public interest. May constitute an appropriate legal standing. And that's, so the constitutional, if it goes wider than that, all of that is captured. So let us just do that, and I think the changes will speak for themselves.
Okay. All right, comments on the, or questions on the changes and comments? Committee vote, Carol.
Is 4 weeks, which is effectively a month. Professor Cheadle, what's your concern about longer? I mean, if you put it within the 180-day context. So you've got to basically request disclosure within 20 days of getting the reasons, a month of getting the reasons. You've got to institute the action within 180 days. This maybe goes through the whole time scale.
Well, you have to request reasons within 90 days. Then the administrator has 90 days to...
Sorry, that 90 days is calendar days.
Calendar day,
yeah.
And then you have to 180 days, which is also calendar days, to institute action. And then we have... our attempt to implied that to set rules. So here, if one starts with a request for reasons, if you haven't been given reasons initially, then you would have disclosure, and then you refuse disclosure, then you have to have you have to bring an application for disclosure. Now, let me just jump back in a second. You apply for reasons, you request reasons. You're not given reasons, you request reasons. Then you don't get the reason. It doesn't give you the reason. Refuses to, and that's where the declining or then you have to apply for reasons. Since reasons normally, and this is not an academic debate here, and this is critically part of the process. We're not trying to make a statement about reasons being a fundamental separate right. We agree entirely that that's the case. We're just trying to manage core processes here and to ensure that everything fits together. We leave it out, we just have an empty a gap, and the courts will fill it in because they will enforce a right to reason. So why not have a procedure to deal with it? Then you've got your reason. Then you request documents. Then the request is declined. You apply for documents. And you have to do all of that, assuming that you've got a bloody-minded administrator. You've got to do that within 180 days. And 180 days translates into 6 months, which translates into court days as 120 days. So bear in mind, we've got to conceive of the structure within that. The second reason why we were keen to link the discovery process to the reasons process is what we don't want to do is to have a situation where reasons are given. The administrator notes down, as I would imagine, the training, how this matter would be, how you train the administrator, say, listen, do everything at once. You make the decision, put your reasons out, put the list of documents that you're allowed, because they're all in front of you now. They're all in front of you. Don't get them filed, and then 6 months later, you have to go back to your file, go and try and find out what documents, and whatever. Do it all at once. Now, the administrator is going to remember the decision, going to remember the documents are, if it's within a reasonable period. If we have to wait 180 days for this, the administrator won't have done it and will have completely forgotten, and maybe the documents get lost. Now, we're not talking about, I know that when we're dealing with the really big judicial review cases, that doesn't happen. But if we're dealing with social welfare grants, I'm absolutely telling you it does happen. And so the critical thing is you've got to find a balance. And I think when I look at the rule again, we've in fact said it's from the date that the reasons are furnished. It's not just furnished in terms of Rule 4. It's furnished in terms of Section 5. And Section 5 says is the date at which the reasons are given. And I think that makes Professor Quinault's argument even more compelling. Because if the administrator does the job properly and furnishes reasons the same time as the decision is made, okay, then you really are forcing the person to apply for pre-discovery in too short a period. 15 days just doesn't work. So what we've got to find is a balance, trying to hang, and what we did is we really looked at how do all these procedures, if they happen all at one after the other, can that logically fit in within the 120-day court day type concept? And the view that Professor Quinault has now brought, that if the reasons are furnished at the same time, we've got to give a reasonable period for the person to make a pre-application discovery. Balanced against, we can't make it 180 days, for obvious reasons. But more particularly, the administrator, if they haven't done their job at that time, is going to struggle to find the proper documents. So what we really want to do is we want something, and it may well be that 15 or 20 days is insufficient. I don't have a mandate from the minister, but I'm quite certain that given the reasons that have been raised here and the concerns raised, if that we could shift that. Bear in mind, dealing with court days, so the question is maybe, I would be very worried beyond 6 weeks or 8 weeks, is my sense. And even 8 weeks, being very close to the maximum.
Does the court have the power to change it? Because let's say there are compelling circumstances why the person couldn't make the 20 days. They live in a deep rural area. Communication is a problem. Would the court have the problem to condone a longer? Would the court have the power rather to condone a longer period?
Yes. If you look at page 7 of the document, 6 rule five, rule five. Application for variation of time. If an administrator fails to respond or refuses to agree to a variation for a time period, the requester may apply to court for a variation of the time periods in sections 5.1 and 2 and 7.1 of the actual rule.
5.1 and 2 is about reasons, not this is about discovery. So I didn't see it as being covered by 5.
All the rules.
All the rules. Okay, sorry, I missed that piece. Okay.
Is that not better? I mean, you know, my difficulty with this is that we have, I mean, motion of Administrative Justice Act 2000, we are 2009. If we don't pass it now, before we rise, then there's going to be a new Justice Committee which will have to grapple with the issues all over again. So I think you're looking, I think I'd set the rules for 2010, but maybe it would be 2011. You know, so we've got to actually reach finality one way or the other and have something. I think the committee in adopting the rules should call for a review within probably 2 years. I mean, it will take time. The minister will have to proclaim, then the rules need to work for at least a year, and then one should see how they've worked. So that's a sort of general point. But to my mind, the 20 days seems fine as long as there's a period can be a variation can be condoned, and that then is there. But I don't know. That's not what other members feel.
I'll just say something. You know, I think we must remember that what we're doing here is giving the applicant an additional procedure to get information. So, I don't, if you look at it in that light, it's not really bringing the application. That remains 180 days, but it's bringing this application, this pre-application procedure for disclosure.
Other comments, questions?
Yes, Jefferson, I think 20 days would be a reasonable one because when you look at the time in totality, you would say that at least there should be some finality reached to a matter. And I think, of course, this is a sort of thing. I think it is a way for asking for coordination because
while we're on the 15 days, there's another 15 days for you have to, within 15 days of the refusal, failure or refusal to supply documents or give access. Should that not also be changed to 20 days? So that would be on page 8. I think those references are there. Sorry? Well, it starts with 2C, 2D.
Other
comments, questions? Maybe wider? I mean, Professor Quinner, I know you're seeing it for the first time.
I don't know. Can I ask a question on Form C yet, or shall we wait until we have that in front of us? Can we talk about that, or shall we stick to the rule for the moment? Okay. I mean, I can just repeat what I said before. I think 20 days is not enough. If there's an offer of 8 weeks on the table, I think I'll take that and push for more, but... I think 20 days is not enough, and I think we'll run into a position where those applicants that can least afford it will be forced into asking the court for extension. And I think one has to ask whether we can afford that. You know, whether we want to afford those applicants that's really the most vulnerable, that's reliant on judicial review to the largest degree, that they are forced to ask the court to extend time periods, and there's no way of knowing how individual courts are going to respond to that. You know, whether I'm living in a rural area is going to be sufficient to convince a specific judge to grant an extension. I'm worried about that. I don't quite agree that this disclosure mechanism is an extra mechanism. I see it as replacing the filing of the record in terms of Rule 53. So I don't think it's an extra mechanism. It's a different mechanism. And it replaces the current filing of the record. So it's not an extra mechanism. That I don't think is correct. And if one bears in mind that this moment, an applicant can, at 180 days, obtain the full record, thereafter amend the notice of motion. That now restricting them to 20 days will be problematic. So I would certainly push for more. I don't think that the 180 days is really a cap. I would have certainly just said, well, just give them 180 days. I don't think it's a cap. I think if there were problems with Professor Cheadle's bloody-minded administrator, those are instances where you can ask the court then to extend the deadline. Then I think there are good reasons. I wouldn't provide, and that we've seen come through the case law, in fact, where administrators dragged their feet and made it difficult. Then, of course, are quite willing to grant the extension. I think those are the proper cases where extensions should be asked. But not if we can up front come up with realities of people who are to rely on these rules that will routinely force them into a position where they need to ask extensions. I think that's problematic. So I would suggest that simply go with 180 days in the Act, and I think there are good reasons for that in our reality. And also, to argue the point that, you know, an administrator may not know any longer what he or she did based on the fact that he or she did not do her work properly the first time, I've got great difficulty in using that as a reason for not forcing them into chairs. The chair has also mentioned that we know that administrators do not formulate reasons up front. We know that they do not provide reasons. Well, I think the very purpose of this Act and everything under it should be to force administrators into a new way of operating. And I think this can be one of them. If administrators formulate their reasons, drop lists right from the start, I can see no reason why there cannot be 180 days to ask for that.
The 180 days is to start your action. Okay. So before you start your action, you've got to get documentation. So isn't there a conflict? I mean, you need time once you've got the documents to prepare your action.
Certainly, but surely that's up to the applicant to decide. I mean, that if the applicant asks for the documents at 170 days, he or she knows that, should know, that they've got only 10 days to file the notice of motion after that. But that's up to the applicant to figure out. So, you know, we're now going into the question of what do we consider to be the adequate preparation time for the applicant. Surely the applicant is best placed to make that call. So I would suggest just leave the mechanism in a time frame as it is at the moment, which is the 180 days. How much time the applicant wants to prepare the notice of motion after that is surely up to the applicant.
I can't see it working. I mean, because you've got to give administrators a time limit. Otherwise, they will. If I were a magistrate and somebody brought an application for review, and they said, well, they only actually applied for the documents 10 days ago. Then obviously they need more time to prepare their case. Anyway, I think we. I don't know if there are any other comments on the issue. Research. Christine, Julian.
I just want to query the fact that the department.
Negotiations. I think the issue is basically knowing how the bureaucracy works. Is it a fair and also knowing the conditions in the rural areas and the problems with people bringing applications. And there haven't been any submissions from, I don't know who's here from the public, whether there's anyone, say, from the Black/Advice offices. But there haven't been any submissions from the people who usually end up bringing cases on behalf of those kinds of people. I think that's the balancing act. But I think we're not. It's a question of do we feel, not what not trying to seek a balance or whatever. Do we feel that period is reasonable? Generally, so far from two members, three members. I mean. Mr. Sebagnoni, Ms. Johnson, myself, Galek has been silent on this. We've felt that the 20 days is enough, I mean, which is basically a month. But it is after you were given the reasons. So you have actually started a process. But I don't know, do any of the other people at the back, where are you from? Yeah.
Nila Meyer. I'm working for the German Development Corporation, and we are working a lot with CDW, Community Development Workers. And seeing the problems CDWs have in explaining to their clients the processes of administration, the needed action, also problems with transport, as Professor Klinel said, or making the decision to act actually, I would support the notion of Professor Klinel to actually allow the applicant to have a very long period to decide or to act to receive information as a document. This is only in order to prepare the process for the court process for the applicant. So it should be his or her decision how much time actually they want to have for the procedure in front of the court after they have seen the document. Thank you.
The issue is that I would have liked to have heard from somebody actually doing this, not somebody who's working with people who's doing this. That's the difficulty. But anyway, are there any other comments? Carol?
Well, maybe just once again to try and compromise, and I know I'm negotiating. But, I mean, if everybody's comfortable with 30 days and with the proviso that you put it in the report that the time frame will be reviewed by the ministry, I don't know if everybody can live with that thing.
Professor Cheadle, you came with the 8 weeks. 30 days is 6 weeks. I mean, just in terms of the balancing act, because that's unfortunately what it is. What's your view?
Look, I think the issue is not just within 180 days. You've got to construct a set of rules so that
yeah.
procedures can take place within 180 days. So it's not just leading to the applicant. We are concerned about the applicant, but we've got to have a process that can be complete within the 180 day period. And I think the process that I've outlined, all the steps, assuming that it goes one after the other as opposed to all at once, which is possible, is that I think that it can accommodate a 6 week to 8 week period. So 30 days would be, it seems to me, work. You could go to 45, but I really would have a problem after 45. Because then the whole architecture of these processes starts collapsing. But we could live with 45.
45. I'm just sort of worried. I mean, in terms of knowing some of the processes that we've got to get here, I'm worried about your mandate. I mean, yeah, and whether you will carry everybody within. The area that you come from with you.
You're quite right to remind me of another set of negotiations, which really are negotiations. I think I can persuade those that need to be persuaded from 30 to 45, but I think you're quite right.
Well, it's from 20 to 40. I mean, you've come with 20 on the table.
Yeah.
You're then going on another 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Are you sure on that, Professor Lewis?
Thank you. One also important to put in place your step-by-step procedure. It's important from the applicant's point of view. It's important for those community development workers who are giving advice. I'm afraid it's just human nature. If you leave it at 180, they'll only start the procedure at 180. That's the way it works. Whereas if you can see this either as a first step in the judicial review application, but strictly speaking it isn't, because you don't have to take this step. You can. It facilitates your judicial review application. And so I think it'll actually be to the advantage of applicants who don't have the benefit of sophisticated legal advice and who would usually be relying on advisors and NGOs to put in place a realistic time frame. So I personally would go with the 30 days. I think 6 weeks is reasonable.
I would be more inclined for the 30 days, in spite of Professor Cheadle's generosity. And also having to deal with some of the people you had to deal with. I hope this isn't being televised or anything. Okay. And that is, in fact, then doubling what was originally proposed. I don't know what other members of the committee, Elizabeth, you've kept you quiet. Mr. Simagnoni had to leave due to catch a flight.
Well, I'm fine with 30 days. That was what I was proposed.
Yeah.
That was better than me.
Okay, and 30 days is 6 weeks. Is it the after 6 weeks? And you're keeping it as 30 days from having got the reasons when you requested, because the point I was raising is the gap of what happens if the reasons are given up front. That could actually be more problematic, because the person gets the decision and gets the reasons and then doesn't know what to do about it. And that could end up with them sort of sitting on the thing abnormally long. But they've actually realized that they must do something. So they've started the process by saying, give us reasons. So presumably they're starting to be in tune. I mean, I think there's an overall question of one of the responses that's come up with these hearings is that the whole issue of access to justice, and particularly administrative justice, is something which is enormously problematic for your ordinary person. And I agree with the point that these rules don't necessarily really help. And the fact that you've got court days and you've got ordinary days, your average member of the public is probably non-comprehensible. I mean, how do you explain that to a non-lawyer? So it's something I think that in the new parliament, that we should be maybe as part of the exit report suggesting that there are hearings on the whole access to justice system. I don't know why you're smiling, Professor, but anyway, I think that would be an area. So Professor Cheadle?
I need to make it quite clear here that if you look at Rule 4.3 on page 6, what we're looking at is the date the reasons are furnished. They're in fact furnished. So that's the date from which you calculate. So if it's furnished, if the decision is made and the same day they give reason, then the 30-day runs from there. You'll see it says Section 5 of the Act, which is when the reasons are furnished, or Rule 3. So it's either the result of Rule 3 or it's done in terms of Section 5.
Clause 5 Section 5 is any person whose rights have been adversely affected and who has not been given reasons may, etc., etc. So I would still read it as not applying to people who are given reasons up front. So Section 5 is about you didn't get the reasons and you therefore make use of Section 5 to get the reasons. So I think there is still that gap that I was raising. I think from the point of view of the access to justice, people who got reasons up front may need more time because they've still got to think about what they're going to do, whereas with having requested reasons, they've already started a challenging process. But I with respect, don't agree with you on Section 5 applying to furnishing of reasons, it's requesting. But anyway, let's not have a debate around that issue. Professor Quinnan?
Yes, Chair. I mean, I agree with you that I think there is a gap. There's another gap, I think. And that's where you don't want reasons. And the students have been talking. What I hear is on the basis that you're required to request reasons before launching a disclosure mechanism. I understand the rules not to require that. I trust my understanding is correct, that there's no need to request reasons. Right, okay. Then there's another gap. When no reasons are asked or given, when will the time period start to run. And I think there is a gap, as the chair points out. So I think it's two gaps.
You're challenging, shouldn't you, if you want documents, shouldn't you know why you're asking for those documents? And you're asking for documents on the basis of the reasons that you were given as to why your application was refused. So I don't have so much of a problem with that.
And the rule says at any time, and then if you a maximum, the maximum, if you don't ask for reasons, and you don't get reasons, you don't want reasons, then it's gone. The point is this, that what we're saying is you can ask for it at any time, but no more than 30 days after the reasons have been furnished. If they haven't been furnished, you can apply, you can ask for it. And if you don't want the reasons, you can ask for it. So I mean, the way it works, it says it's at any time. And where does any time begin? It begins when the administrative action is taken. When does it end? It's 30 days after the reasons are furnished. So if the reasons aren't furnished, you can apply.
Okay, Rule 7 then, the application where to compel disclosure and access being made within 15 days of the failure or the refusal, you spoke about increasing that to 20. Is it appropriate to increase that to 30? Or is it a different
it's different because what is different
it's a different category, yeah.
Yeah, it really is. I mean if you start adding all these days up, you're gonna end up I'm trying to say to you, you know, you've just gotta keep the architecture in rough sort of place. If you don't get the reasons, you've got 2 weeks to go to court. And by the way, if you don't get it, you don't get to court in time, you apply for condemnation and you explain why you're not there. That's ordinary rules of condemnation then apply. Because the ordinary rules relating to the court apply. And in any event, you don't have to. You can wait. You can make your application and seek full discovery under Rule 35. And in the High Court rules and the equivalent rules, the magistrates will find their name. So the point is that you've got everything that you ever had.
What are you saying about the 15 days for bringing the application?
I think there's no reason for that. If you're ready to start instituting an application, we're outside of a law centre now. We're in a lawyer box. Okay. If you want to institute judicial review. I know that there are cases where people will write a letter to the court and ask for and bring an application in handwriting. But by and large, if we're looking at what's taking place here, what you're dealing with is you've got to make these applications for administrative review are difficult applications to make. It's not an unfair dismissal case in the CCMA. You have to have a whole range of thresholds. Our substantive law is such that you have to meet a whole set of requirements. And PADA itself is not an easy statute to understand. So really, once you start talking about applications, I understand this is about requests, but I cannot say once you've been to applications, then employ. I must say that if you start squeezing, you start expanding the period for the request, then quite frankly, you've got to be, I think you've got to be really careful about changing the knock-on day. And I don't like the things.
Okay. Any other comments? Have the forms been given out now? Okay. Professor Quinner, you had an issue on the forms?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. As been pointed out in that top block, those references have been removed, but of course they remain in the form, and on the three specifically. And I think that remains problematic. That, in my view, is not in line with standing even your own name. So materially and adversely affect your rights. That's certainly not what the Constitution requires in Section 38. So I've got a problem with that. And I think I haven't had time to look, but there was another block that I didn't see on the overhead. I just need to look at that quickly to see whether that's also now been changed. It remains on page 2, part D, the top block. Again, refers to that. I don't know, there was reference to something being changed to May, which may change it. I haven't had time to look at it.
On the form, what is the point of taking, I mean, the blocked block is the explanation. What's the point of taking it out of the explanation? I mean, I think I understand why the requirement of material and adversely affecting your rights. I mean, this is requesting documents. Otherwise, it's floodgates. But why have you then taken it out of the explanation?
It's not in fact. If you go over to the next page, you will see where is it? If you go to page 3 of the form, and it's numbered at the bottom of the page, in fact, it starts on at the bottom of page 2, and it has that really handy block deleted right at the bottom of page 2. And I think what it's meant to say, any person representing those whose rights have been so affected, and that means would be the material adversely affected, that's a representative capacity, or a person acting in the public interest, may have legal standing. Just an explanation. May have legal standing. And those are the three categories. Now, why do we include materially and adversely affected? Well, because you cannot bring a case for judicial review as an individual, on your own, with your own interest, unless the... and you've been materially and adversely affected, because that's the definition of administrative action. Administrative action itself is defined as a decision that materially and adversely affects your rights, and rights, of course, as the courts have expanded. So I don't want to start putting court language in here. The courts will interpret this because it's drawn from the definition itself. And so the point simply is this, that if you're applying, that means personal locus standi, that means my rights have been adversely affected. That's one ground from which I can come. Then I want you to fill that in and tell us what rights and how have they been adversely and materially affected. Important, because this is a document that will trigger a court application in due course. And then the new paragraph 4 says, are you applying in another capacity? And that's any capacity that is constitutionally permissible under Section 38. So you say, yes, I'm doing it in the public interest. Yes, I'm doing it in a representative capacity. Right? And then you would state it. So, quite frankly, the form now meets Professor Quinault's original objections and concerns, and I think they were correct, and I think it's unnecessary to go any further. What we've done is we've started an explanation. I think Professor Quinault says he doesn't want it in the form. Well, with the greatest respect, what we want to do here is we want to ensure that the person who applies for disclosure is properly apprised of all the requirements that he or she has to make, or it has to make if it's an NGO, because if it's going to compel the administrator to grant access and inspection of documents, then it's going to have to meet that test in the court. And the best place to put it is in the form. And these forms are very, very important, and they work exceedingly well in the Labour Court with the CCMA, and there's a lot of stuff in that which, you know, technically doesn't fit. But the point is this, it allows the Commissioner to be able to process the form and respond to it properly. And bear in mind, we want administrators to do their job properly, and we don't want them to give to people who have no right to it. And so, really, that's the function of it being here, and I think whatever the objections were around Section don't know what happened in the process, but as you know, there were negotiations around it, and there was a much, at one stage, a much stricter view as to who could have discovery, could request for disclosure of documents. But that battle was won, and now any person, even a person in representative capacity or in the public interest, anyone under, that has standing under Section 38 of the Constitution, can now request disclosure. And the form just didn't properly follow it, but I think now it does.
I had a different issue just from the submissions, and that was something that we made it now. But on Rule 3, the point was made that it starts any person whose rights are material in adversity if rejected by the administrative action may request the administrator to furnish written reasons. And the point was sort of made in Section 5 of the Act, there's also that requirement of and who has not been given reasons for the action. What's the reason for not including that? I mean, assumingly, if you're going to request, you haven't got them. I mean, it's implied. But would it not, yeah, just, do you want to comment on that?
What it does is broken it up. We just assume that people who've got reason are not going to ask for reason. So you apply, and then you'll see the administrator in subsection 5 may refuse the request for reason if written reasons have been furnished. And we've expanded there the concept of written reasons are publicly available, and the request is informed of where and how they're available, which is really a subcategory of furnishing reasons.
Yeah.
The request is not a person's right to materially affected, and that's because of the wording in 5 itself. It says only those people can request reasons. And it's reasonably injustifiable to depart from the requirements under 5.4, which is, as you know, there's the process where an administrator can depart from giving reasons. And so really what we've done is we've taken the conditions and contained in Rule 5 and put it as the reasons for refusing reasons. And again, to draw attention to the administrator. The administrator looks and says, this is the box I'm ticking. This is why I'm not giving reasons. If you embody it into one, then the administrator, yes, the administrator then has to interpret Rule 3.1 to have the condition. So really, it complies.
Yeah. Okay. Other questions, comments? Carol, you look puzzled.
I just saw Mr. Quino's shaking his head vigorously at some point, but he's happy. Maybe happy is overshooting because of that.
No, I am. No, it was just on a thing of what would result in a rather sterile legal debate between me and Professor Cheadle about the reading of the definition. I fundamentally disagree with his reasoning, but I'm quite happy that if he says the purpose behind what's now being put in Form C is really just to reflect Section 38, I'm happy with that.
Okay. So,
it's
a proposed amendments. There is a document I've just seen which we've been given now, which is the summary of the submissions and the departmental response. I actually don't feel it's necessary to go through that because we've largely covered the areas. Some of the, I think it's useful reading it, and some of the comments also, not from Professor Quino, but were a bit off the wall. So I think the issue then is as far as the proposed amendments, the one amendment we would then also like to see is the 15 day, or your 20 days to become, what did we say? It said 30 days. 30 days, yeah. Noting that Professor Cheadle wanted 45. Anyway, but that's the one change would be made. I don't know if there are other changes. The minister's then going to withdraw the rules, and he would need to retable on Monday. I see the NCOP is dealing with it on Tuesday, so it would need to be
And we would, I think, to the committee section, we should meet on Tuesday to formally agree with the rules. So they need to be tabled on Monday so that they can be referred out to the committees by both houses on Tuesday morning. But aside from that, I don't think anyone's found anything else that they want changed. So I think that's largely as far as we can go. As I mentioned, we're dealing with these rules. I mean, it's not the best time of year. Professor Quino, I, before you came, had mentioned it's only the ANC that are here. The other parties, DA, IFP, actually never pitched. DA, IFP, and ACDP, who usually do attend, were not able to. Well, ACDP gave an apology. I'm not sure about DA because it's election time. This has been an ongoing saga. We need to get some form of finality. I mean, the third set of rules that were tabled, it was the committee that was unhappy with them supporting the rules board, and that's why those effectively got ground to a halt. So we need to look at finalising them. But I think this is what we do when we put the resolution to the House, and it should be a report from the committee, is to say, you know, we would have liked more time. This is a sort of new area. We'd like to get a report either from, I don't know whether the rules board doesn't report to us, Professor Lewis, it'd have to be the minister. To ask the minister to report back to Parliament within 2 years of date, not of implementation of date, on their implementation and potential problems. I think that the point of the CDW is actually, I mean, who assists people in on the ground. I don't know whether it's formally part of a CDW community development workers training, but I think it would be useful. Sorry, is it formally part of their training? No.
It's at least part of a new scope and a new mandate of CDW to inform citizens about PACHA and indirectly then also part of the training.
Okay, but maybe within the resolution of the report from the committee is to say that we feel it should be formally part of community development workers training to inform people and to assist people. Maybe it's also something in constituency offices that training can be done. So I think we could look at those kinds of things, and then I think as part of the exit report to the new committee, to recommend to the incoming committee after the elections that they look at the whole issue of access to administrative justice and hold wider hearings. There were people I understand from Bubuletu who wanted to come, I think not so much to make a submission. Sorry? So one is here. But I understand the issue was more a specific problem with housing and administrative decisions taken on housing rather than the issue of these formal rules. So I think what it shows, and I think also Dr. Naidu's submission, is that generally the public are calling for greater simplicity in the whole issue of access to justice, particularly on administrative decisions. So I think that should be part of the proposal to the new committee, is they need to properly go out into communities and hear from people on the issue. So having said that, I don't know if there's anything else that anyone wants to say. You will then withdraw the rules, or the minister will withdraw the rules, retable the amended ones on Monday morning, and we will then, if we can meet on Tuesday morning to formally adopt them as and then I think from the researcher side, if you can, those points I've raised, if you can prepare them in a report, let me have a draft by Monday morning, and then we can circulate it to the other members by Monday afternoon. Anything else anybody wants to say? If not, then to thank everybody for their attendance. Oh, one point, so is anybody here from PMG? Okay, so it's not your fault, but I don't know if you pronounce his name, Bracha, who's a partner with sort of established Cape Town firm of attorneys. His submission was to you, to PMG, and it was then CC'd, copied to us. Now, I'm not sure how that came about, and you could explain.
public than you can on from attorneys. But I think if PSG can please make sure in the way you convey the Parliament's request for public submissions, that you make it clear that you're not requesting the submissions, the submissions have come to us, because in fact the submissions were sent to you. I don't know what you're going to do with them, and they were just copied to us. But it's just if you can follow that aspect up. But if not, then to thank everybody for their attendance, Professor Quino particularly as the sole person wanting to make an oral submission. I assume your problems were with the N1, N2. I'm told the N2 was clear. But otherwise, to thank everybody then for attending.